You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast roundtable on online learning. My name's Chris Parr, I'm a reporter with THE and I'm joined by three people each with a different take on the world of web-based education. Kyle Dyer is Senior Lecturer in Addiction Science at King's College London and was tutor on the institution's Understanding Drugs and Addiction MOOC, which was delivered earlier this year on the UK MOOC platform FutureLearn, which is owned of course by the Open University. He also leads a taught Masters in Addiction Studies and an online Masters in International Addiction Studies delivered via distance learning. Diana Lauriard is Professor of Learning with Digital Technologies at the Institute of Education London, spends much of her time at the London Knowledge Lab, an interdisciplinary collaboration between the Institute of Education and Birkbeck College that brings together computer and social scientists from a broad range of fields to look at new ways of learning. She also developed a MOOC for the Institute of Education and is widely regarded as a leading expert in digital and online learning in the UK. Shai Rashef, the third guest, is the founder of the University of the People, a tuition fee-free online school that offers accredited college-level studies to students across the globe, including those in areas badly hit by war or natural disasters, such as Haiti after the earthquake of 2010. The university has admitted more than 2,000 students from over 140 countries and is determined to democratise the higher education process the world over. Shai, maybe I could start with you, since you're the third on the list. Could you give us a sort of a rundown of the challenges that sort of you've faced delivering higher education online in some of the more remote parts of the world? Because I know that's something that you see as a key aim of the University of the People.
I guess that the main challenge for people is to get internet access. I wouldn't say that we face it, because if they don't have internet access, they don't come to us. But we do know that a lot of people are restricted because they don't have internet access. Mm-hmm. Others, because of English. We only teach in English, and English is a big barrier for a lot of people. When people do connect to us and start studying, if they are from remote areas, they have internet connectivity issues. So we have students who study from internet cafe. We have students who study with a cell phone. We even have one student that we know of, maybe there are more than one, that use USB, going to internet cafe every day, downloading the material from the classroom, mm-hmm. go home, working on it, and then go the next day uploading the material and downloading it again. So internet connection is a big issue. Obviously, at the beginning we had to face with the issue of how do you recognize or identify the students that you have. How do you know that the documents that they send you are the right documents? So being online bring you challenges that I think can be overcome, and we do overcome them, but there are challenges. So,
yeah, and Kyle, I guess you will have experienced that to an extent. MOOCs at the beginning of the 2012, when we were first starting to talk about these ex-MOOCs, if you like. Mm. It was all about democratizing education. It's all about sort of reaching people in hard-to-reach areas. A lot of that's not really been delivered, has it? I mean, what have you found with your MOOC? Was it predominantly people in the EU, in the UK, in the US, those kind of markets that already have good access to education?
Yes, it was, but I'd add the caveat there that when we delivered our MOOC on FutureLearn was still on beta, so we were capped at 10,000. The marketing wasn't quite there. We did have 92 different countries of residents participate, but you're right, the majority were from the UK. Mm. I was just reflecting on what you just said, Shia. When I delivered our MOOC, I was also delivering a distance education module and a talk course module at the same time. And often I'd be on the MOOC in the morning, I'd give a lecture on the talk course, and then at night be on distance ed. And I'm still scratching my head to reflect about what I did differently in those three different forms. Mm-hmm. I know that I felt when I teach with the talk course, I can see faces, I can feel whether I'm going at the right pace, I can gauge engagement. Now, when I deliver online or with a MOOC or with a distance ed, I'm far more limited by what people are writing, how quickly they're writing, and whether they're enthused by what I'm saying. So there is a distance that we're forever trying to bridge, I think, in distance education.
Mm. I one of the things that we are different is that we don't use broadband. Mm-hmm. So quite a lot of our students just don't have broadband. So we make sure that everything is typed. well, we don't see the students, they don't see us. On the other hand, it's very interactive in terms of the students have to post their, they have to write their own contribution to the class discussion, they have to comment on other people. But one thing that is very important for us is that we put our students in classes of 20 to 30. So we make sure that they have the personalized attention they need. So it's kind of a different offering using technology, but yeah, it's interesting, the difference. Yeah.
That's an interesting point. I mean, Diana, I know you've been fairly blunt in the past about, you know, some of your critiques of MOOCs. I know you wrote in Times Higher, in fact, about some of the overhype that they were subjected to. And a lot of what you write about is the quality of student experience and how you can, well, if you can replicate that at scale. Shai's there saying, you know, classes of 30. Kyle obviously, I think, had about, was it 10,000, 11,000 people on the course? You know, the very different challenges, aren't they? But have we got to a point where we can, you know, we can recreate the experience a student has in person online?
No, because we can't ever get past that need for students to be in groups of about 20 to 25. I mean, just as Kyle was saying, as Shai was saying. And at the Open University, which had 200,000 students or thereabouts at any one time, they are tutored by associate lecturers who have groups of 25, 30 students, that kind of number. And when you're providing higher education, when you're trying to get people through degrees, those students need that kind of guidance and nurturing. What we're trying to do is change people's minds. You know, we're creating, helping them become a different kind of person. Education is not that kind of mass delivery industry like Amazon or something where you can just deliver the knowledge to them and that's it. You've got to help them, got to engage them in understanding what they can be, understanding what these new ideas are, understanding what new skills are. And that does take a different kind of education. Where I think MOOCs are particularly successful is where you have people who already understand how to do that. So for professional development, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did with our MOOC. We were able to do that. So certainly that's one kind of MOOC where I think you can work it. If you orchestrate the student groups to be supporting each other, when they're professionals, they do that very well. You don't always have to have a tutor right in there. And then there'll be others, and I think possibly the kind of thing that Carl was talking about could be very different, where you've got different kinds of communities who have a lot to say to each other, and that could be different again.
We use discussion boards in distance learning quite a lot. So on my talk course, MSc, there'll be a discussion board, discussion topic. That's how we create that engagement. We did the same thing with the MOOC. So we had a set discussion topic each week. And that got by far the most number of hits, most number of comments. But one of the beauties of the FutureLearn platform was the social networking field. People could comment spontaneously on lectures as they saw it. So I've been looking at closely at those posts. When there was a discussion board, by far the most learners answered, but that's what they did. They answered the question as if it were an assessment. When the learners could respond spontaneously, there would be threads, there would be discussions, there was engagement with each other. And our role as teachers or educators was not to get in the way of what was naturally evolving. So I think we assume a lot if we just try to apply distance learning into the world of MOOCs. And I don't think at the moment we really understand this world, but it's an exciting, changing world.
Yeah, that challenge of democratization is a big challenge. I don't think we've done that yet. I think it's possible that somewhere like the University of the People does achieve it because you set out to do exactly that. I think the Open University achieved it because it set out to do exactly that. But MOOCs haven't been able to do that yet because they don't provide that kind of education for massive numbers of people.
I can't agree more with you. I think that the MOOC is a great thing by spreading the knowledge and giving the opportunity to millions of people, being exposed to great professors, great courses. But as you said before, it's the very people who have the right background, who have the self-discipline, who have the knowledge. For people who have, I keep saying that the MOOCs are for the haves. It's not for the have-nots. We're trying to reach DevNuts, but when we look at our students, they can't make it through the MOOC. Put them in a class of 10,000 or 100,000 students, they won't be able to make it. They need a personalized attention. They need someone to take them and actually educate them, maybe prepare them to use the MOOC later on.
So how do you run it? I mean, you've got 2,000 students. You're putting them in classes of 30 to 40. You're not charging them any tuition fee to do this. Who's staffing it? Who's keeping an eye on it? Because you may say you sort of opted out of interfering with a lot of discussions, but surely for a class with accreditation particularly, interfering at the right time and making sure students aren't going off in completely the wrong direction is quite an important part of a teacher's role.
Every class has an instructor. The instructors are volunteers, so they're coming at least to us as volunteers, and maybe we give them honorarium in order to show them that we appreciate what they do. But every class of 20 to 30 has an instructor. We have academic advisors that follow the students. So it's a very, actually, it's a peer-to-peer learning. But the role of the instructor is to be there to verify that the discussion is going well, it's going to the right direction. If someone has a question and nobody was able to answer, or if someone said something wrong and nobody was able to correct, the instructor get involved. They can approach the instructor outside of the class or within the classes. Now, so it's a very structured setup. The instructors are volunteers. By the way, we use about 100 volunteers.
And they're all university, they're university teachers, university lecturers.
They're all teaching courses that they teach elsewhere. They come to us to volunteer to teach our students. We use 100 out of 3,000 volunteers that offer their help. So we are actually now ready to grow, hopefully to be able to use all of them. But still, they are there to verify. We verify that, there is a system. They study, they take quizzes, they hand in their assignment, which are graded, by the way, by their peers, supervised by the instructor who can override the grade. By the end of the course, they have an exam. The exams are proctored. So there is a whole system. That's why we're accredited, among other things. But yeah.
Sure. I remember the last time we met, I asked you whether you saw MOOCs as a threat, because although you're offering a very low-cost education, there are certain just small fees for exams and things like that, whereas MOOCs are completely free. And you said, no, it's totally different. You offer full degrees. Maybe I can flip that question and ask you guys. You both work at institutions, traditional campus-based institutions. We've heard for a long time how the internet might shake up campus-based education, put it at threat. We heard how MOOCs might do that. Well, here, we've got a guy sitting in front of us who's offering accredited university degrees for a matter of a couple of thousand pounds, start to finish, in their entirety, accredited, ready to go. I mean, are you a little bit concerned? Is this going to, will this shake up the way you think that we deliver
education? It's fantastic. I think we should be doing it too. That's the thing. There's no reason why big universities shouldn't have the capacity to do that kind of thing as well. Not that I want to put them out of business, but we should. That there is so much demand for higher education. 100 million people across the world want higher education. We should be able to do this. Mm. We've got the technology to do it. And what we're doing at the moment, it seems to me, is that we're investing huge amounts of money, which MOOCs do take to create, in educating people like us who've got several degrees and are professionals. This does not seem to me to be sensible.
I think we make an error when we think that learners on MOOCs are homogenous. Now, in the Future Learn MOOC that I ran, we looked at intentions to study before and after the MOOC, and we didn't find any significant differences. That is, people came into the MOOC and they wanted to do a psychology degree or they wanted to do a postgraduate degree, and the MOOC didn't change it. They'd already made their intentions. But there was a significant change in people who wanted to do another course in addictions, another short course. Now, the feel that I got from the learners is that there was a large proportion of learners who were commencing their first step towards education, towards higher education, people who didn't think that they would be coming to King's or to a university. We assume too much that people will do a MOOC and then come onto my course. There is a population who will, but there's another population who want a little bit more than the Friday night, Sunday night BBC documentary with lots of great graphics. So I just wanted to say that first. I think we are dealing with a far more diverse group and then I think a lot of the discourse has covered so far in the media and so forth.
I agree with you, and I think that the MOOCs is one more component that is out there. And I think that, you know, looking about whether online will replace the traditional universities, I don't think so. I think that all it does is open variety. So people who can afford Oxford or Harvard will always be there and will go there. What the internet enables us, but not only us, is to say, wait, if you deserve higher education but you can't afford it, there will be another opportunity for you. There will be another offering. So I think that the internet actually opened a variety of opportunities and for people. So there'll be the offline, the online, the hybrid, tuition-free, low-cost, higher cost. So there will be a lot of opportunities out there for people to study.
And it sounds like it's very important when we think about that, to think about what the end game is. What are we after here? And one of the great things for us was that we were working with UNESCO on our ICT and primary education MOOC. And UNESCO has the Millennium Goal of universal primary education. Now, if we were to think, how feasible is it to provide universal primary education? What they've calculated is they need 1.6 million new teachers. How are you going to get them? And then you think about the kind of thing that MOOCs are offering and the number of people that we were able to reach with our MOOC on primary education. And we won't get to the people in the village who've got to teach 8 children and take a primary class, but we could get to the people who teach the people who teach the people.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some hope that if we think about what MOOCs really could do about the democratization and the mass delivery of education to those who really need it, you can begin to see some of those models appearing now, sort of cascade to the people where it's really... But it won't happen unless we think of that as being the end game.
That's right. I just wanted to do a bit of show and tell. It's not great for an audio podcast, but I'm going to do a show and tell anyway. This is a handmade card that I received after the MOOC. It's handmade, handwritten from a grandmother in Melbourne who didn't realise I was also a colonial and knew what the MCG was, because there's a picture of the Melbourne cricket ground on the front and a little description on the inside, and I certainly know hallowed turf when I see it. I won't read it all out, but she says she was a grandmother of, 6 grandchildren aged from 6 to 17. She didn't participate in the discussion sessions because she's not up to date with social media, but she read some of the most interesting views. The course has given her confidence to discuss these issues. So when we ask, what are we hoping to achieve? There are 6 grandchildren in Melbourne whose first discussion of addictions with their grandmother is going to be an evidence-based discussion based on work at the Institute of Psychiatry. Now, that doesn't translate immediately into money for Kings, but what it might mean is that those 6 people, when they think of addictions, when they grow up, they might think Kings, they might think the UK. But even if they don't, they're informed. They're going to get... use more information upon which to base their decisions than what they're getting from the mass media or from television or from their friends. So for me, that's an outcome. Does it translate into bums on seats? Excuse my language. Doesn't matter. We've made an impact. Mm. And I think that's the power of MOOCs. And short courses, distance learning, these are all steps on the learning pathway. The more the merrier.
But you say that as an academic, you know, that's what I often hear from academics is that it doesn't matter whether it converts or not. It's part of the outreach activity. It's part of getting education to hard to reach places. But surely the powers that be, unfortunately, don't see it that way. Then I would imagine you will be getting some kind of correspondence from the corridors of power saying what does this translate to?
Well, 3 students from the MOOC subsequently enrolled in my taught course MSc. So that sort of answers that question. I think we wiped our nose if that's the saying on the cost there. I also had 3 inquiries from my distance ed course. Now, this is what I found interesting. When I was speaking to the taught course students, I said, well, why are you doing this? Why aren't you doing the IPASS? That's our distance education course. And it's because just that they wanted the King's experience, they wanted the London experience. They wanted to study in London. Now, I mean, to me that resonates, and it goes back to something you said right at the beginning. How do we capture that in an online environment? And that means we've got to stop and think, what is it about campus and campus study that we perhaps all enjoyed as undergraduates ourselves? And are we actually creating that environment, that social networking, that chance to hang out, that chance to be
the scholars? Reason is, as I think was indicating, is people still go to Harvard and MIT because that's where you meet the CEOs of tomorrow. You're not going to meet them online. It's not the same. You don't get to play basketball together or whatever. So the campus experience is...
Do you think the University of People will have any graduates go on to be CEOs of big companies, or is that not your...
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will, because some of our... You know, we have an agreement with NYU. Well, our best students can be accepted to NYU Abu Dhabi with generous scholarships so they can afford it otherwise. And NYU signed the agreement because it's clear that we can be a great funnel. People who come to us would never think about NYU, because when you look at it, at the $200,000 tuition, it's something that they can't even perceive. But we have not all of them. You know, some of our students would be very happy for them to graduate with a quality degree and not be a CEO of Fortune 500 companies, but some, why not? I mean, we have quality degree. I'm sure that some of them will continue to graduate schools with best universities. We are very lucky to have on our Council of Presidents some of the best presidents of the universities, which I'm sure would love to meet our students. But to go back for a second for the experience, you know, there is the experience of being in a campus and meeting your peers, etc. But there is another experience that we supply to our students. First of all, when you look at the young generation, their way of interaction, they hardly meet each other. They are online meeting each other. Well, that's how they meet their peers with our setting. But more so, every time they take a course, and a BA with us is 40 courses, they meet 20 to 30 students from 20 to 30 different countries. If you're talking about a global citizen, if you're talking about exposing them to the world, they can never do it in, you know, you go to a campus, and to a physical campus, brick and mortar university, and maximum you meet 20 international students, 30 international students, that would be a lot. And they go with you for the entire duration of your studies. In our case, every 2.5, you meet 30 new students or 30 new countries. That's just, I think that's the major gift we can give our students, opening their mind, broadening the spectrum of the world, you know, creating like a well-rounded students, open to different cultures. I think that's a real gift that we can give, traditional university just cannot. So,
but a difficult teaching job, I suspect. So many different people, different languages, different backgrounds. Mm. I imagine that's quite difficult
that
to tailor pedagogy to.
It isn't.
You know, for us, it was a challenge, partly the language problem that you mentioned. But then, you know, Google Translate is a wonderful thing. And there were people coming in speaking Russian in the forums. Well, you just paste that into Google Translate and I could follow what they were saying. It was fantastic. But the students also helped each other. And there were all those problems of the technology, because we had 44% of our participants were from emerging economies.
Is this in the primary education?
This is in the primary education MOOC. And that meant that they very often had challenging technical problems. In some places, they couldn't get access to YouTube. Very often, the students would sort this out between them, and they would sort of find ways of helping each other. I don't know if it's just because primary school teachers are particularly kind people.
No.
But, you know,
they're people
fantastic.
Are kind.
You know, they really were working together, collaborating together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was fine.
I have to agree with what you both said. We had something like 17,000 discussion board posts on the MOOC. Now, we were delivering a MOOC on addiction, so there were people who were pro-drugs, there were people who were pro-recovery, pro-abstinence, there were doctors, there were users, there were parents, there were people in recovery. Half the people who did the MOOC had a personal experience of addiction, either directly or from a loved one. So I spent the night before the MOOC started not sleeping, partly because my little boy was teething and partly because I was really worried about what was going to happen on the discussion board and thinking this could be the end of my career when it all goes bang and people are whatever. Of those 17,000 posts, we only had to remove one, and that's because a learner posted a link to a cracked version of the DSM criteria. So that is a broke copyright. So that was an incredible experience. It really was.
Who was reading those 17,000 posts? I spoke to someone who did a FutureLearn MOOC, said they didn't sleep for 4 weeks because they were up all night going through posts, taking them down. Now, that's fine for an experiment, but you wouldn't want to be doing it full-time, would you? Who was monitoring?
I can only speak from my own experience. I had a core group of really enthusiastic postdocs, and we just monitored the discussion board from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, and we had shifts. But really, we learnt early on that the power was amongst the learners. They were happily engaged, and all we were doing was drawing them back to the evidence. That is, it was a very soft approach of teaching. We were there, we knew we made sure that they knew that we were online, but really it was more about joining in as peers as opposed to teaching in that old didactic style of teaching. I was very aware that we were all part of a shared community, and I think it's very hard to put that into words, but that is the difference between good online course.
I think that's great, actually, when you're learning from your students as well. I mean, that's the best kind of academic atmosphere. But I think you do raise an important point about the extent to which you can be in there helping them in those huge forums. And what we tried to do was set the ground rules. We would say that there are these forums that we will be part of, and then you set up your own and you can do what you like in all the others. But if you clarify that you're going to undertake to look at certain of them, and another thing was to get them to work together in order to produce, let's say it's just one definition of a concept or it's one example of the way to do something. And then you get all of the groups to work together themselves, and you've broken your cohort of students up into maybe 20 groups, let's say. Then you've just got 20 outputs to look at. That much you can manage. So you can get them to say, here's our best effort at this definition, and you look through 20 definitions, you give feedback to all of them. They've all been involved in creating those definitions. It's a kind of pyramid approach to going from a huge cohort to just a few manageable outputs from that huge cohort. So those are the kinds of pedagogies that we have to start developing to be able to adequately support students in the kind of way that you're mentioning. We become part of the conversation, yes, fantastic, but we also guide the conversation in the conceptual development and some of those sorts of techniques, I think.
And I think the key point you made there is that you set the ground rules first. Yeah. You create a safe learning environment where learners are aware that they need to respect each other but can share their views, and we draw it back. This is a learned group. These people are coming for a reason. If they want to talk about other matters, there's Twitter, there's Facebook. Those conversations will go offline. But within the learning environment, it becomes a very supportive environment. So if we can have an addictions MOOC where you can have a drug user and somebody in recovery quite happily chatting with each other about neuroimaging or genetics, then there's something exciting happening which we need to be involved with and look at.
Well, I'm wary of time. I think we've 5 minutes or so left, and I asked maybe we should use that time to find out what's next on your horizons in terms of what you're all working at. Shai, I know you had a graduating class at the University of the People. I mean, first, before I ask you what you're planning next, do you know what was the completion rate of sign-ups of that cohort to those who actually got an accreditation?
It's still hard to say because all of our students work, so none of them graduate in 4 years, and we actually give them up to 10 years to graduate. So we have our first 40 graduates, but it's hard to know. What we do know, and we are very optimistic, because while at the beginning we had quite large dropout because we were not selective, letting anyone in. Now when we are verified that people are more ready and we give them much more support than we gave them before, 75% of the people who matriculate continue to the second year, which is actually much better than community colleges in the U.S. We're quite satisfied with it, and we hope actually for it to increase. Do you want me to talk about it?
And your plan, absolutely. Your plans for the...
The first milestone for us was accreditation. Accreditation was important for our students, important for us to show that what we do is legitimate and respected. The next milestone is to be financially sustainable. When we have 5,000 students expected to have in 2 years, and 5,000 paying students who pay $100 per exam. And after we have $5 million for donation, we become sustainable. And from that point on, we can grow 100% per year until we serve all the 100 millions that are out there. Along the way, we plan to develop two additional new programs. One would be health science, just because of the huge need in developing countries for health workers. We also planning to offer MBA. That's what our students want. That's what we give. So it's growing dramatically and improving our quality, improving results, and offering more programs for the people who need them.
Diane?
Well, I think MOOCs have had a great effect on getting people interested in what learning technology can do and on a large scale. People are thinking about it. It's on the agenda, and that's really important. But I think having in mind those big challenges of education is very important. That's what we're after solving. It's the problem of the 100 million students who want higher education, the 1.6 million teachers who are going to make universal primary education possible. What can we do to work towards that? And I think it's some of those things we've been talking about with respect to the kinds of pedagogy that we can offer. Exploring that. We're not at the moment really enabled to find out from MOOCs what we can do for undergraduate education. That's the really big powerful change for me.
Sure. And Kyle?
It is. Well, the quickest answer is that we're repeating the MOOC in March. So this gives us a chance to have a look at, we were very successful in our first incarnation. Can we maintain that success? Was it just because of the novelty of the new, or were we onto something? Within my day job at King's, we're looking at, or what I'm looking at, is how can we incorporate some of these personalised learning experiences into my talk course and into my distance education course. So on my talk course, I've been trialling flipped classrooms at postgraduate level, and that's working really well. In my distance education course, I'm trying to capture that essence of what is it to study at King's? What is the community aspect that brought people from the MOOC to the Strand campus? How can I capture that in my distance education course? So I'm trialling things at the moment, such as I've got an art and culture special interest group, which I'm hoping that the distance ed students will work with the talk course students so that they get a feel that these are real people and real teachers. Mm-hmm. So we're repeating, we're trying to incorporate some of the lessons from the MOOC into our daily activities, both in my course and across the IOP, but I'm just trying to capture what is the essence of being at a university that we can put onto the digital world, and that's, I think, the real challenge, and that's what's making me excited at the moment.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Kyle Dyer, Diana Lauriard and Shai Reshef for joining me today for this discussion about online learning.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.